London is the place for me. London, this lovely city. You can go to France or America, India, Asia or Australia, but you must come back to London City.
In June 1948, in homage to his impending arrival in Britain, Aldwyn Roberts began composing lyrics to London is the Place for Me. It's a calypso that eventually became part of the soundtrack, chronicling the history of Caribbean migration to Britain after World War II. The migrants came at the invitation of the British government, which was facing a labour shortage due to the destruction caused by the conflict. A cruise ship called the Empire Windrush carried almost 500 passengers from Jamaica to the UK, including Lord Kitchener, a calypso singer from Trinidad. By chance, a local newsreel company filmed him singing London is the Place for Me as he got off the ship.
To live in London, you are really comfortable, because the English people are very much sociable. They take you here and they take you there, and they make you feel like a millionaire. So London, that's the place for me.
My name is Young Warrior, a reggae sound system operator in the UK. I'm also a DJ, music producer, and son of the historic dub legend Just Shaka. In this special World Service documentary, I'm going to tell you the story of how people like my grandparents in the Windrush generation literally brought their music with them, and how it changed Britain forever.
When a man is good, he's good. Kitchener singing as he really should.
Before ska music, before reggae music, Caribbean music meant calypso. It was the official soundtrack of Black Britain in the 1950s and early 1960s. I started my journey by talking to composer, broadcaster and calypsonian Alexander D. Great about how the Beatles were influenced by a calypsonian and how the BBC played its part in introducing calypso music to the UK.
Calypso was big in England because calypsonians came to England and there was work, particularly in London and Manchester, there seemed to be, and also a bit in Liverpool. And I'm going to make the link here and I will stick my neck out. Well, I have to stick my neck out. It's a well-known fact. The Beatles were seriously influenced by a calypsonian. His name was Lord Woodbine, otherwise known as Harold Phillips. At the age of 14, he stole his brother's passport and came to Britain and joined the RAF, saying he was 17. He flew for the RAF, he went back to Trinidad, then he came back on the Windrush, and he went up to Liverpool, where he'd been billeted before, and he ran a club called the Jacaranda, to which Paul McCartney and John Lennon used to regularly come, and he would teach them to play pan, and they would ask him about sevenths chords and how to make different moves and all of that.
So Larry Constantine, Knight Bachelor, Black Prince from the British Empire. Cricket was his life, and through the game, this grandson of a slave won great fame.
In the 50s, it was so popular, it really was really popular, that the entertainment industry was worried about rock and roll. Once Rock Around the Clock had come out, and then Presley came out in 56 with his stuff, they were worried that the whole of the teenage world would be seriously corrupted by this new music. So they really tried to sell calypso as a music that wasn't going to make their kids go crazy, but it didn't work.
Cricketer, dynamic and debonair, called to the degree of the utter bar. He later became High Commissioner.
An interesting thing is the BBC in the 1950s, in fact late 1950s and into the early 60s, they had a guy called Cy Grant, a famous actor. In fact, he was an RAF hero who'd been shot down in Holland. He'd spent 2 years as a prisoner of war. He went on a show called Tonight with Cliff Mitchell-Moore, which is a news show, about 6 o'clock in the evening, 6:30 in the evening, on BBC, well, it was only BBC One at the time, BBC and ITV. And he went on and used to do a roundup of the day's or the week's news in a short calypso.
Good evening. Edinburgh, India, Devonshire, Bristol, Wales are some of the places you'll be hearing about or seeing. But let's hear, first of all, from Cy Grant.
And it was very, very effective because the great British public, there must have been quite a lot of them, certainly more than 10 million, who would have watched this show and would have seen this very good-looking black actor with a guitar singing the news.
We bring you the news you ought to know with tonight's topical calypso.
So that's how the British public were introduced to calypso, right in their living rooms in a way they may never have done unless they went to clubs and things where calypso has been performed. And the most of the places would have been the big metropolises, you know, London, as I say again, Liverpool, Manchester, places like that.
Born in Trinidad in all humility, he rose to the ranks of high degree.
Calypso music wasn't just big in Britain, it was big all over the world, according to legendary DJ David Rodigan, a man who fell in love with Jamaican music in the 60s and still has a reggae music show on the BBC.
We're here in London at the BBC headquarters in the UK, and I'm here with Mr.
David Rodigan.
How strong an influence was calypso music in the 50s?
It was very influential, and I think we have to point out that Harry Belafonte was the first man to sell a million records on an album. He was a Jamaican, was born in Harlem but reared in Jamaica and then went back to Harlem and then eventually made an album of which there was famous songs on there such as Day, Missa Day, Missa Day, Day in a light and me won't go home.
Work all night and a drink a rum. Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Calypso was very important because the whole essence of calypso was the fact that these calypsonian singers were reflecting what was happening in their society, be it in Trinidad or Barbados or wherever. And of course, there was calypso singers in Jamaica as well.
Daylight come and me want go.
The calypso music brought by migrants to the UK showed that there was a market for Caribbean music. Soon, entrepreneurs and record labels were finding artists to bring over to Britain. A perfect example of this was Island Records. This label later signed Bob Marley and Toots and the Maytals. But their first big success was a teenage girl called Millie Small, who was brought to Britain by Island's founder, Chris Blackwell, in 1963.
My name is Lawrence Kane Honeysett and I've worked for Trojan Records for the last 25 years. I started listening to Jamaican music in the 60s and joined Trojan around actually 1990, since which time I've stayed with the company as the Jamaican music consultant, putting together releases, writing books, you name it, I've done it. The mainstream introduction to Jamaican music in the UK was really My Boy Lollipop by Millie Small. She came over from Jamaica in the early 60s and recorded the track in the UK and was amongst the first Jamaican Afro-Caribbean artists to have commercial success outside of the Afro-Caribbean community. My Boy Lollipop became a huge hit and got massive radio airplay, was a massive hit, number two in the UK, and a big hit all around the world. So that was the entry point for most people of non-Afro-Caribbean heritage to discover music from the Caribbean. A number of Jamaican artists came over in the wake of Millie Small's huge success. People like the Rudies, the Pyramids, a number of artists like that. And they played a mixture of ska and soul within the UK and helped spread the whole sound out of Jamaica. Ska started off from the Jamaican sort of ghetto, really, came from sound system culture, and that was in the late 50s, early 60s. There were a number of hugely influential Jamaican producers such as Duke Reed and Cox and Dodd, and they would carry their sound systems around on the back of trucks around Jamaica, playing originally American R&B. And the sound of R&B that was most influential or most popular amongst Jamaican audiences was American rhythm and blues with a certain style. People like Roscoe Gordon, Fats Domino were particularly popular. A lot of their records emphasised the backbeat, and that would develop into ska by the early 60s.
David Rodigan's passion for Jamaican music was sparked as a youngster when he watched Millie Small perform her hit on the Ready Steady Go TV show.
How did you find reggae music, or did reggae music find you? Which one?
It found me as a teenager. In the summer of 67, I was blown away by this new music from Jamaica, which was called ska. I'd heard snatches of it in 64, 65 with Blue Beat, the classic everyone knew because it was a pop smash, which was My Boy Lollipop from Millie. I remember when my father was buying records, I saw the new Blue Beat sound on posters with Laurel Aitken.
What was the first reggae record you've purchased?
The first record I purchased with the name Reggae on it was Do the Reggae, spelled R-E-G-G-A-Y, on the Big Shot label by the Maytals. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the first record I bought, it was Telstar by the Tornadoes, mm-hmm. and that was, I think, in 1962. The first album was definitely Club Ska 67. That was the album that, if you didn't have that album, it's like, you know, what planet were you from? Mm-hmm. So many people had that album, and that album reflected the fever and enthusiasm and passion that everyone had for this music.
The king of ska music was Prince Buster, legendary record producer Dennis Bavel.
For me, in the 60s, Prince Buster was happening in a big way. Prince Buster was like the godfather of talking on ska. One of his pieces where he takes the Ten Commandments and rewrites them is quite funny.
The Ten Commandments of Man, given to all man through the inspiration of I, Prince Buster. Thou shalt have no other man but me.
People were at that time thinking, what's this new reggae thing? Then singers like Desmond Dekker, Toots and the Maytals, Jimmy Cliff, all these people started servicing on a new label brought by Chris Blackwell to London. This was his new reggae in England label. The record label was called Trojan.
Get up in the morning slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelites.
Many of the pioneers of black music in the UK were the producers working behind the scenes. They didn't become famous, but according to Lawrence Kane Honeysett, they made their mark.
Ireland started up in the UK in 108 Cambridge Road, and in the basement of 108 Cambridge Road was a little studio, and it was the first studio that was actually owned and managed by someone of Afro-Caribbean descent, and someone who's been largely overlooked in the history books. And his name is Sonny Roberts, and he went on to form and manage Orbitone Records. Sonny was a pioneer and helped people such as Dandy, and the Marvels, and a number of UK-based Jamaican acts get their music recorded. In the late 60s, numerous other producers of Afro-Caribbean descent made their mark on the British music scene, largely through Trojan Records. You have people like Joe Sinclair, Des Bryan, Webster Schroeder, who'd begun their musical apprenticeships working in record shops, selling Jamaican music in Lee Gopthorpe's Music City record shops. And they later became in-house producers, as of course did Dandy. And Dandy Livingstone, real name Robert Thompson, he was the first Afro-Caribbean producer who lived in the UK to take reggae into the mainstream when his production of Red Red Wine by Tony Tribe made the UK charts in the summer of 1969.
Red, red.
For Jamaican musicians coming over to England, the experience was overwhelming. One successful act was Dave and Ansel Collins, who had a huge hit with Double Barrel.
I am the magnificent. I'm back, but the shaker was so boss, most thundering, storming, sound of soul. I am W-O-O-O, and I'm still here.
Hi, my name is Trevor Starr, guitarist from Kingston, Jamaica. I'm a member of the Dave and Ansel Collins band.
And hi, hello, my name is Dave Barker, a.k.a. Dave Collins. You know, and, whoa, I tell you, we are here, right here in Carnaby Street. You know, shucks almighty.
Yes, Dave, you know, it's nice to come back to Carnaby Street after all the time. I feel a bit emotional, going back to the roaring 20s where we used to rave, you know, the first time I came.
Those were the good days, man. We landed here, man, and we were brought straight to Carnaby Street.
In the roaring 20s.
And it was amazing. The people was excited seeing us, meeting us, you know, they bought us drinks, made us feel at home, and we danced, and everything was just fun, man, wonderful. Yeah.
You know, and this is where all the musicians and artists used to hang out. You know, it was good to see some of my friends and who was here before us, like the Pioneers, they were here as well, you know, Desmond Dekker. So when we came up, it was like home. And actually, this was the first black club, so we didn't have much places to go, you know what I mean? So, it's very emotional for me, you know?
W-O-O-O.
Smush. it's good. Me and you talking about this thing, dear. Yeah, I mean, now that, you know, we're getting up in age, you know. Yeah, so I mean, we kind of set the pace for the music scene here. Yeah, because, yeah, you know, the reggae music was just coming from the ska and the rock steady, you know. So when the reggae come on it here, it was like, wow, you know what I mean? Everywhere we go, we caught the place. I remember, you know, Roadblock. Yeah, that was some nice.
I was amongst a group called The Sensations, Johnny Osborne, and guys like that. And one night, we were on West Street, and the phone rang inside. Winston rushed in, got the call, came back out, looking very excited. And Winston Riley said to us, guys, that was a call from Trojan, England, London, saying that we need to jump on the plane like now to come to England because Gubba Barrel is on its way to the number one slot.
That's Dave and Ansel Collins and a number called Double Barrel, the brand new number one song. You will never forget that again, will you?
No, I won't.
Thank you very much indeed for watching. Hope you enjoyed the show. Be back with us at the same time next week for another edition of Top of the Pops. See you then. Bye-bye.
What was Top of the Pops for you? Because, you know, when I came up, I missed the Top of the Pops show. You know, you already done one series of Top of the Pops with some different guys, you know, and some of the guys from Jamaica.
Well, it was a very, very strange experience for me. Because coming from Jamaica, simple reason why, when we were rushed to the BBC to appear on Top of the Pops, when we were called out to do test runs, I was bumping into guys like Rod Stewart, Cliff Richard, all the other people, Lulu. And I'm saying, wow, is this real? You know, am I really here? Anyway, cut a long story short, it was a wonderful experience. But I must say this, I was extremely nervous. But in the nervousness, I was still very, very excited.
The success of Double Barrel was built on its appeal to the white working class youth in the UK, particularly among those who called themselves skinheads. Now the term is associated with right-wing politics and racists, but the original skinheads were all about fashion and loved black music. Lawrence Kane Honeysett sees the music as bringing together different communities.
It was really reggae that proved vital in ending the rift between black and white teenagers and sort of a cross-pollination of sounds to the charts. Really, it was Trojan at the time was promoting reggae in the late 60s. And it was at that time really where you had the most unlikely group of people from white background championing reggae in the UK, and they were the skinheads. I mean, really the first group of skinheads, the first generation of skinheads to come along, they were the fashion kind, not the fascist kind. And they were very much into Jamaican music. And really, it was a mingling of cultures in the late 60s, really, that had a profound influence in terms of multiculturalism that would later follow. It was from that time that reggae started appearing in the charts, thanks to their buying power.
Al Capone, guns don't argue.
West Indian music was breaking through to the pop charts. But for the Windrush generation and their children, their musical culture was separate from the mainstream. It was based on local record shops that sold the hottest songs from Jamaica and the local sound systems that played the house parties.
And then there were specialist people who were bringing in records from the Caribbean, from Jamaica mainly, like Peckins, who had his record store. But this record store was servicing mainly sound systems. And then the few people that knew where they were, because their records were a little bit more expensive than ordinary released records, because they were pre-release records, they were imports. This kind of helped make reggae what reggae is around Europe.
I went to visit the home of Peckins Records, an award-winning reggae label here in London. Chris Peckins told me how he's continuing the legacy of his father, George Peckins Price, who established the business as a record dealership in 1960. George was the first person to bring the Jamaican sounds to the UK.
So here at Peckins Record Store. So tell us about Peckins.
Peckins was my dad, the late George Price. He grew up in Jamaica with all the great producers of today. So we're talking like Duke Creed, Coxon Dodd, Lee Perry, Prince Buster. They had a sound system. There was two big sounds on the island, Coxon and Duke Creed. My dad was with Coxon, who was the pioneer of Jamaican music, really, Studio One. My dad came here in 1960, the first person to sell any form of Jamaican music in England. It's a hub of Studio One. You could only buy Studio One from Peckins forever.
Yes, sir. Yeah. One, two.
Specialist record shops were crucial in spreading music from the Caribbean to the UK. David Rodigan told me more about record shop culture at that time.
record shops were kind of sound systems, really, because the sound systems they had in there were so amazing that often when you got home, you put the record in, it didn't sound like this in the shop. You want to take it back, you think, I got mugged off. That sounds crap. But in the sound system, with everyone in the shop, with everyone, I'll take one of those. And you get it home and you put it on your own tin pan sound. It's like, this is terrible. So shops for sound systems.
DJ Elaine Smith was one of the first wave of UK female black DJs. She went on to present the BBC's flagship chart show, Top of the Pops, in the early 90s. This was decades after pioneers like Millie Small and Dave and Ansel Collins had appeared on the show. DJ Elaine told me how her mum used to buy her music from record shops in Brixton Market. She wanted to be the first in her area to get the latest Jamaican songs, and she didn't want other people to know what they were.
Well, when I was growing up, what I remember my mum playing a lot would be ska, rocksteady, you know, the Millie Smalls, a lot of John Holt. Cherry O' Baby was played a lot.
So was your mum the more musical one?
Yes, definitely more than my dad. It was my mum. My mum used to buy two records every single week from Brixton Market. And I'm pleased to say that I still have quite a few of those 7 inches. And she thought she was some sort of a sound system, because when you look at her 7 inches, she's crossed out the names, because she complained that the woman next door used to come and copy her titles, so she crossed out the names. Whenever I look back at my childhood, we had a lifestyle that was all ours, the way we dressed, the way we partied. We still had a lot of our parents in us from the christenings, so we still had the traditions of our parents, and we still loved our parents' music, but we were raging against a system. So a lot of us, much to our parents' disappointment, took on the Rastafarian movement. You know what I mean? We weren't even Rastas, we just jumped in and out of it.
You're listening to BBC World Service Radio. In the second half, we'll tell the story of how the children of 1950s West Indian migrants made their mark on music. They even made their mark on politics, with movements like Rock Against Racism that emerged in the 1970s in reaction to the rise in racist attacks on the streets of the UK. We'll also look at how multiracial groups emerged from the inner cities of England to dominate the charts with new versions of reggae and ska that they had heard while growing up. Welcome back. I'm Young Warrior on BBC World Service Radio. We are going to look at how sound system culture was brought to the UK with the mass immigration of Jamaicans in the 1960s and 1970s. For those that may not know, a sound system is a large-scale discotheque, or PA, which can be transported around the globe. My father, Jashaka, has been operating his Roots Reggae Jamaican sound system since the early 1970s. And by the end of the decade, he had rapidly gained a large and loyal following thanks to the combination of spiritual content, high-energy rhythms, and his dynamic personal style. My father used to play his sound system at house parties for our kind of people, which were Jamaican people. We didn't have places to go. There wasn't any radio stations playing our music. There wasn't much for us. So we had to create our own community. We'd have DJs, rappers and singers in these house parties. Maybe the female of the house running the bar and the kitchen. And you would have the party across two floors, in your bedroom and in your front room. Later, community centres, town halls and even concert halls became the place for our music, where artists such as Maxi Priest or General Levy got their big break. Well, I followed in my father's footsteps to create my own sound system, linking young people to the heritage of the original sound system culture, which came from Jamaica and the Caribbean. English DJ and record producer Ronnie Size talks about growing up listening to sound clashes and how the film Babylon introduced him to sound system culture.
I remember growing up, we used to get these tapes, and these tapes used to come from London. There was two sound systems. There was like Sir Coxon and there was Saxon. There was Jah Shaka as well, of course. You know, everyone knew who Shaka was, but Shaka didn't have the MCs. Shaka was just strictly bass lines, roots music, and, you know, window shattering music. But Saxon and Coxon, they had the MCs. And these two sound systems were the heart of London. They were where it happened. This is where it all came together. You would hear them clash each other. Sound clash, sound clash. I remember watching this film called Babylon, and this film changed my life. Babylon was sound system. It was a group of black guys. Each person would have their role in sound system, and they would hire a van, and they would build these speakers, and they would take them to anywhere which they could, and they would just play sound system all night long. And Babylon showed us what we wanted to do. My most memorable night ever was sitting down. I was too young to go out, and sitting down at home and listening to David Rodigan versus Barry G. And this was live on the radio. It was an amazing event. It was this clash of all clashes. There was a certain point in the clash where David Rodigan just draws for this one tune by Wayne Smith called Slang Tang, and bass line comes in. Kills it, you know, for David Rodigan to go to Jamaica and go on their own turf and to play against these guys and to win was incredible. It was the best school to ever go to for someone like myself.
Another music star who grew up with sound system culture was Pato Banton. He didn't just get his love of music from sound systems, he got his name.
My name is Pato Banton. I was born in London, England. Moved to Birmingham, England at the age of 8. My stepdad was a DJ. And at the age of 8, I started helping him with his sound system, listening to the early music coming from Jamaica. Our house was actually the community night spot. People used to come over about 10 o'clock until the hours of the morning, drinking, talking, dancing, listening to music. And I was actually the security lookout because the parties were illegal. So I was the lookout at the age of 8, 9. And that's how I got my name, Patu, which is a Jamaican owl that comes out at night and says, Patu, Patu. Growing up in Birmingham in the 70s was an interesting experience. We were just getting over the worst of the racial tensions. It had been a rough childhood for me, I guess, living in an environment where the police were hostile and the National Front were still active.
Michael Riley of reggae band Steel Pulse thinks the heavy bass of the sound system style changed British music.
To what extent has reggae and bass-inspired music impacted the music industry?
Jamaican music changed the sound of music production, changed how we listen to music, that is, the equipment we listen to music on. It changed our tolerance for low frequencies, because initially music was produced for radio, it's mid-range. It changed how we engage with music within a space, because it's an outside mega disco, if you like, that's brought inside because of the climate in the UK.
So then that basically gives another tick of certification to the sound system, obviously playing this music on a louder scale, on a deeper level, other than the radio.
The sound system production, that is music that's produced for sound systems, when played on radio, sounded completely different. And for a long time, they were winding out the bottom end on radio to place it back into a spectrum, audio spectrum, that they understood. But what they also found is that people were saying, actually, that song sounded really great on the radio. How was it produced? And they didn't really understand that it's produced for being played outside or on larger speakers, sound system setup.
Without sound system, there'd be no reggae, according to one of the major British writers on black music, Lloyd Bradley.
I'm here at the BBC headquarters interviewing good friend Lloyd Bradley, author of Bass Culture, When Reggae Was King. What is sound system?
It was this interface between the producers and the consumers of music, where it was almost a democracy. You need to attract crowds, so therefore you need to do two things. You need to satisfy the crowd you've got, you need to give them what they want, but at the same time, you need to extend them a little bit. You need to move them in a certain direction, but beauty, I suppose, of a sound system is you haven't got a series of marketing meetings and video budget conferences and all that as to what record are you going to release, and then it gets released in 4 months' time. You cut a tune on a Friday afternoon, you play it in your dance on Friday evening, and the crowd are 2 foot away from you, and they're going to tell you if they don't like that record or not. If they don't, you'll never do another record like that again. If they like it, you'll release it. By next Friday, you'll be in the shops, and you'll cut half a dozen more like that. So you can't get anything moving quicker than that, or being in such contact with its audience. It's like, this is what the audience want. It's not a bunch of 40-year-old A&R men telling teenagers what they want.
So you've spoken a lot about sound system. So does that mean sound system was very crucial in reggae music? Did sound system need to be there?
If sound system wasn't there, then reggae wouldn't be there. It's as simple as that. You know, there's absolutely no way of getting away from that. Every single development in reggae had happened on a sound system. You can't name one that didn't.
In 1972, one of the pioneers of reggae, Bob Marley, came from Jamaica to London to record Catch a Fire, returning to record Exodus and Kaya in 1977. Bob's son Julian told me about reggae culture in the 70s and his father's legacy.
Well, being Jamaica, being the house of reggae music, so basically the creation of reggae music stems from Jamaica. It's such of a cultural thing because obviously when you go to England, you're surrounded by every nation, all Caribbean islands and, you know, different people of the world. So for me, we give thanks for those early settlers of the Caribbean people coming into the UK in the 50s. That brought their culture, their music. To me, my father is my university of music. When I study him, you know, like he got to school, he's the school of music for me, you know. And then opening up the door from there, then you start to listen to anything else you want to listen to, jazz, blues, funk, pop, dance, or whatever, you know. But first music where we listen is Bob Marley and the Wailers. Reggae music means not bowing to any oppressors and getting things together as a people, you know, universally. So the culture for me in the 70s was very vibrant when it comes to the reggae music. You know, a lot of positive things was happening. You know, you had Bob Marley, you had Peter Tosh, you had all of these great. English reggae now, being born in England now, you know, Aswad basically lived a few doors down from where I live. We are very rooted in that culture.
The group that lived down the road from Julian Marley were Aswad, one of Britain's most important reggae bands. Their lead singer was Brinsley Ford.
I think in the UK, reggae music was generally the sound systems. There were a lot more clubs that you could go to and hear reggae music. I remember in the early days in Harrow, where several times I'd watched Toots and the Maytals or the Pioneers. Some good friends of mine were the Cimarrons, and I travelled a lot with them up and down the country in a van. Another place was Burton's in Cricklewood Broadway. Either Trojan or Duke Finn or lots of different sound systems would come and you would listen to all of this music. Also in those days, we had the situation where you would have a band playing, but it would be the sound system and the group would probably use 212 speakers. And normally when the band got on, it just didn't have the same power that the sound systems did. And this was one of the things that I think Aswad were the first to do, to take a PA. But suddenly you had like 100 watts of PA kicking out and they had to stand back. We were singing about the things that affected us, what we were going through. And in the early days, obviously, it was the black situation. We were all young, black, British-born young men. And later on, I think during the times of the three-day week, the coal strike, when things started to really change, I think, in the UK, we started to find that people came and said, I can identify with what you're saying. You know, that's the time when people started not to be able to just come out and find an apprenticeship and just go straight into it. Things started to get more dark in the UK. And then after a comment that was made by a well-known musician, they started Rock Against Racism. Rock Against Racism gave a platform for everything to have a voice. And I believe that that was one of the building blocks of where we are today, because it meant that 50,000 people who would not have listened to reggae before were suddenly now in the same place and listening to a bit of reggae and then listening to a bit of this. And I like that. I can go with it. Police and thieves in the street.
Rock Against Racism broke down barriers, but one thing it couldn't do was stop the racism experienced by young black men and women growing up in the UK. Michael Riley of legendary Birmingham reggae band Steel Pulse.
I grew up in Handsworth, as did the other members of the band, and we grew up as first generation black British born individuals, which meant that the experience of being Jamaican, whilst removed, was reinforced by our parents who were, as a community, were en masse. It was a very tight Jamaican community where the culture of Jamaican or Jamaicanism was strong. That came with the music. That came with the politics, that came with the experience of being black and being British, but the complexity of being first generation black British. So we're simultaneously Jamaican, hardcore, but we're born in Britain. So we are the generation that grew up with that identity crisis. Are we more Jamaican? Are we more British? To let me go was not their intention. One nigger, the less, the better, the sure. But there was a reality growing up in the 70s, which was you're being told you're not British by the state, by the government, by the police. The band represented that identity crisis and realizing through reggae music that we had to stand up and be counted. We had to fight to discover who we were and then fight to hold on to what we were. And so that came about in realizing we were not going to talk about Jamaica because we don't know Jamaica except through the music. So we embraced our British experience and said we have to put that into the music.
Many of the bands growing up at that time were mixtures of black and white youth. The Specials, UB40, The English Beat, they all took Jamaican music and remade it. In Birmingham, reggae singer Pato Banton was part of that scene.
In the 70s, what was interesting growing up in Birmingham was that there were two town bands, there were black and white musicians. During the 70s, it was a time when I was just leaving school and becoming an adult and becoming a musician at the same time. There were great bands like Steel Pulse, UB40, The English Beat. I used to enter a lot of talent competitions and just take any opportunity to get noticed. I remember The English Beat were playing at a theatre in Moseley, just up the road from me. And what was interesting, they had a talent contest just before The English Beat were going to perform. I managed to get to the contest just in time to sign my name before it started, so I was the last one on stage. Once I went and performed, The English Beat judged me as the winner, and Rankin Roger invited me over to his recording studio, and we ended up recording a song called Pato and Roger Ago Talk. Also during this time, UB40 were huge. They were climbing up the charts, and they were working on an album called Bag of Rhythm, and they were inviting local artists from across Birmingham to come and sing or rap or, you know, DJ on the album, and they gave me two tracks on their album.
The new generation wasn't just breaking into the charts, it was also making their own style of British reggae music. It was different from the Jamaican reggae because it was far less connected to Rastafarianism. And as the name suggests, it was more romantic. Dennis Bavell was one of the producers creating this style when he helped set up the London-based record label Lovers Rock.
Some tracks that come under the genre of Lovers Rock are, of course, Louisa Mars, Caught You in a Lie, Brown Sugar, and the ultimate anthem of that genre is a song by Janet Kaye called Silly Games. I've been wanting you for Once I had constructed this song, Silly Games, I then tried to find a singer who could hit that very high note. I approached Janet to say, would she sing that tune? And she said yes, and you know, the rest is history. It took reggae to a top of the chart position in the UK, and it made Janet Kay the first female reggae vocalist to top the chart.
Music writer Lloyd Bradley sees Bavel's approach as being distinctly black British.
Dennis Bavel was pretty good. He didn't want to be Jamaican, so I think without realising it, he created something that was far more local. And then when you've got other people feeding stuff into it, Janet Kay, for instance, her favourite artists were like the Supremes and this sort of stuff. So she was bringing all that to the party, and she wasn't trying to sound Jamaican. But as soon as this sound started to bubble up, people kind of latched onto it, thought, actually, this sounds like us. This sounds far more representative of us than, say, something that comes out of a studio in Kingston. I don't believe it was a deliberate process, but once it happened, again, it's the opportunism of reggae that it saw something there and grabbed it.
Lovers Rock wasn't just successful in the UK. It crossed back to Jamaica with artists like Gregory Isaacs and Dennis Brown.
Money in my pocket, but I just can't get no love.
Brown was known as the Crown Prince of reggae. I spoke to his daughter, the singer Marla Brown, about her father and her upbringing in London.
I didn't know the weight of my dad's title, quote unquote, until he passed. Because my dad was such a humble, grounded man, and music was something that he loved. But he died when I was 12, so I didn't understand the extent of his contribution to the industry until now, really.
Until now.
Wow, because many people would think if you're like obviously a son of or a daughter of, then that is your biggest influence, your parent is your biggest influence.
No.
But like you said,
real life.
Your dad was just your dad.
My dad was just my dad. And sometimes like people don't get that, yeah, literally, because it was his 20th anniversary not too long ago, in July, just gone. And I always told people it took me 10 years to accept that my dad had gone, but there's always certain songs that I draw to when I need to speak to my dad. So it's just, I don't know, it's bigger than music and influence to me. It's just a way of life, yeah.
So in your household, what kind of music would be playing? What was the vinyl collection? What was the tape collection? What do you remember of those early days of music?
Predominantly reggae.
Okay.
Yeah, because my mum and dad are very conscious.
Yes.
A lot of dub. That's why I love dub. Like, with a passion, props. I love dub. Yeah, I love your dad too. You'll see what love.
How do you think reggae music has shaped the musical genres that have obviously come forward now?
You've got to think, reggae is the foundation, you know? It's Africa, it's our homeland music. Mm-hmm. So it derives from somewhere and from our people, and you will find our people globally. So wherever you go, everyone will be influenced by that. It goes to show how heavy reggae's influence is on us as a people and us as a message, especially where the world is changing so much now and people are wanting to know their roots and their culture.
So now that you've obviously come from reggae, you've got all of these different influences, when would you say would be your first reggae session or sound system session? Or
That's part of the journey. I've been doing it. I remember when I first moved to Jamaica and we had like a street party in Owen Street for Dad. And I battled on the mic on sound system style, which was really nice. It was fun. It was like a playful thing.
So when you deal with reggae music, do you necessarily feel home?
Yeah, of course. And it's kind of like the underdog because it's not commercial.
Okay.
So I find that a lot of people are trying to be a bit naughty, you know what I mean? They're like, what's this music? Let me listen in. And when you go to festivals, I've done a lot of festivals in various different countries, and honestly, it's like they're lifted. And that's what reggae music is supposed to do. It takes you to new heights, and I find that very beautiful across the world. It's not foreign to me, it's almost like a fantasy that I see and I feel blessed to be a part of.
This generation!
Vision with Vision.
By the 80s, British reggae could produce songs that could sell millions around the world. Pastor Dutchy by Musical Youth hit number one in 1982 and went top 10 in the States. Not bad for some school kids from Birmingham. Their lead singer, Dennis Eaton, told me the story.
Back in 1982, when we released the single, we'd had to go back to school, so we didn't want to tell our friends. So we said, we're not telling them, because it might be a failure, might be a flop. Then the charts used to come out on a Tuesday, but that afternoon, the single had gone to number 26, and there was a buzz around the school, and everybody's whispering, blah, blah, blah. And then we'd left to go to London. A week later, the single went to number one. Unbeknownst to the record company, they were shocked because they thought, nah, it was coming in at 55 when it went in at 26. And when it went to number one, they were caught on the back foot. And all pandemonium just broke loose. We then were driving to venues. We were flying from London to Newcastle. So that was one. We didn't believe that we were number one because we were told at 10:30 in the morning and the charts don't come out till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we had to go and listen to the radio to get the results. And then it was just like, I can still remember the tingle down my back of my neck from hearing, and now at number one, Musical Youth. There was a ring of jets and the session was there in swing. So we're here in Birmingham. Birmingham is, for me, the hotbed of reggae music because we've got so many artists that branched out alongside Musical Youth even before. So we've got the likes of UB40, Pato Banton, Apache Indian, The Beat, even though it's a bit more ska, and Steel Pulse. Even Dennis Barvell spent a lot of time in Birmingham. We know him as Blackbeard. We were nominated for a Best Newcomer Grammy in 1983, and we were alongside Culture Club, whose single, Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, was also a reggae track. And then Eurythmics and Big Country, and they didn't have a section for reggae. So the following year, they had a section for reggae, and Steel Pulse were the first recipients of that reggae Grammy. And ever since that year, they've had reggae Grammys. So, and then we went from Jamaica to New York, and we went to do an interview at MTV Studios. MTV weren't playing black artists. We were the first black artists to actually go in and do interviews with MTV, so we got a nice little kudos. For me, reggae is my family and my history and my culture. It permeates through a lot of the music, so a lot of rap. The rap music came from the reggae, and then, you know, what you got, dubstep, then you got reggaeton, and then you got, you know, even rappers now. All we had was people singing about their hardships, especially the Rasta men. That movement had it hard, so they would sing about their experiences. But then the love songs, when you listen to the love songs in reggae music, it's just something to behold. In Jamaica, they created reggae music for an identity because when they got independence, they needed their own. We've got the first generation of the Windrush generation coming over, and their children, second generation now, are thinking, well, this is what my mum and dad listen to. This is what I want to play. When you listen to British reggae artists and Jamaican reggae artists, they play it slightly different. If you listen to the likes of Oswald, Steel Pulse, even Musical Youth, in terms of how we portray the reggae, it is reggae, but it's got a different feel. And reggae is, or anybody will tell you, reggae is always about the feel.
You know, from doing this documentary, I got a deeper sense of my own heritage and a better understanding of the rich mixture of music genres brought to London from the Caribbean. Black British music of the 50s, 60s and 70s was a real melting pot of sounds, taking us up to the present day where the music style is even harder to define. We've got a lot to be thankful for, and I for one know that British music would sound very different today without the influence of the Windrush generation. I'm Young Warrior, and this documentary has been produced by John Offord for BBC World Service Radio.